The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
In wartime, there are very powerful incentives, particularly in the context of total war and at certain periods during the Cold War, for scholars to think more broadly. I mean, especially if they're working in government or, you know, doing work that is commissioned by the national security community, you know, to break out of the silos. But for most of us, and certainly this was the case after the major wars and at certain periods during the Cold War and after, when those incentives go away, then the incentives are, what do your colleagues think? What does it take to get promoted and tenured? What sort of work is going to get you a seat on a panel at the American Political Science Association convention? And most importantly, what sort of scholarship is going to appear in the flagship journal? And those are pretty powerful incentives, particularly for younger people.
I'm Jacob Schultz, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 20th, 2019. David Priest sat down with Michael Desch, professor of international relations at the University of Notre Dame and the director of Notre Dame's International Security Center, to discuss Michael's new book, Cult of the Irrelevant: The Waning Influence of Social Science on National Security. They discuss the different roles of social science in the policymaking process and the value of academic scholarship for policymakers. They also talked about the history of the relationship between the national security community and academia, and about how to bridge the gap between these two worlds. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 445, Michael Desch on Social Science and National Security.
We want to talk a little bit about the relationship between academia, especially in security studies, political science more widely perhaps, and policymaking. And this centers around your relatively new book, Cult of the Irrelevant: The Waning Influence of Social Science on National Security. There's a lot packed into that title and subtitle.
About a mellifluous title, I think.
Yeah, it's about influence. It's about influence. It's about influence lost. It's about this relationship. But let's set the parameters first. We're talking about scholarship, particularly in the security studies area, and we're talking about policy.
And particularly academic scholarship, which is important to highlight, because one of the big changes over the last generation has been the rise of para or extra academic scholarship, which I think is inextricably linked to the rise of the cult of the irrelevant. If you're not getting it from the academy, you still need scholarship, particularly in the social sciences.
What do you have in mind? What are some of those extra academia scholarship zones that you're describing?
Well, I mean, the most famous ones are the FFRDCs, the Federally Funded Research and Development Centers, most famously RAND, but places like the Institute for Defense Analyses, the Center for Naval Analyses, and places like that. And that's part of the story that I tell in the book. Think tanks, including the one we're at here at Brookings, also play a role in the story, although it's a more mixed role. And, you know, then you have, and this sort of touches on your career, in the intelligence community, the internalization of the research function within the bureaucracy itself. I mean, it's always been there, but I think it's become a much bigger thing, you know, as a result of the failure of the academic supply side of the whole equation.
Yeah, let's talk about that supply side. Actually, let's talk about both sides at a high level. Why do policymakers need what we would call scholarship of any kind? Why is it, in the simplest terms, why is it that they need to engage with academia and others who are providing this kind of work?
I think there are two distinct arguments, but they're mutually reinforcing. One argument is sort of specific about expertise. You have people in the academy that spend their whole career, 30, 40 years, developing deep expertise in certain issues, much deeper than even subject matter experts within government can ever develop. And a lot of times this work doesn't touch on important issues and sort of, you know, is left to the ether or the classroom or things like that. But every now and again, deep knowledge of Pashto tribes in Afghanistan, the result of 30 years of field work and things like that, becomes absolutely critical to national security policymakers. And you don't have that expertise within government. And so being able to tap that to answer pressing policy issues that maybe emerged in the late 1990s as a result of a good buddy of ours from Saudi Arabia taking up residence in Afghanistan. That's an important national resource and one that we've long recognized, although it's been a challenge to maintain. So that's one argument. But the second argument, and this is more high theory or political philosophy, but I'm a big believer as a classical liberal in the intellectual marketplace of ideas. Mm-hmm. And what capitalizes our intellectual marketplace of ideas is that in an ideal world, it's populated by a lot of people with very different intellectual backgrounds. So I think that the discussion, for example, of national security issues in our country is greatly enriched by not only having it dominated by voices inside the Beltway, people in government or out of government in the think tank world and things like that, but also by people, and I flatter myself here, but there are a lot of us you know, out in the hustings who think about these issues in a very different way. And maybe sometimes we think about them in a cockamamie or naive way, but I think there are a lot of instances, in fact, where we bring some interesting insights to the table that at least should be part of the conversation.
And perhaps on two fronts there, Mike, because on one front you mentioned and you started with, well, what about those regions and issues that just aren't on a typical policymaker's radar? You know, that she isn't thinking about Afghanistan until she needs to, or tribes in Yemen not being important. And I think you cited in your book that George Kennan, the diplomat, wrote that policymakers need academic expertise because they have to make decisions about issues and areas of the world, in his words, about which they cannot be expert and learned. That makes sense to me. But you're talking about something else too, which is even on the issues that they come in with views, beliefs, knowing that they're going to have to devote time to, let's say, Russia or China, sometimes they need that framework that good academic work can provide, some of the sense of history and what has gone before and what does that lead us to in terms of a generalization about world politics that will help guide them in terms of strategic policy.
Yeah. So they're, you know, subject matter expert in academia can provide often a lot of color on an issue that a policymaker, even a policymaker with substantial experience in an issue, might not have. I think the other thing is that I think you'll agree with me on this. If you're part of a bureaucracy, there are certain bureaucratic incentives and pressures that sort of constrain how you think about a particular issue. So having somebody who's thinking about the same issue but with a different set of priors and institutional constraints, I think is healthy. That's not to say, you know, that academics are omniscient on these issues or that their policy recommendations are necessarily better than, you know, somebody that's working the issue inside government. But I do think, again, to go back to the classical liberal argument, that the more voices you have thinking about an issue, the better the debate about it is.
From the academic side, take a professor of international relations at a typical large university or even a small university. Why should they engage with policy? Because there are a lot of obstacles in the way to doing that effectively. Why do that instead of getting the more immediate rewards of what academia values?
Well, I think there are a whole host of reasons for that. I mean, I've found personally, as someone who's been primarily an academic, although I did stick my toe in the policy pool early in my career, but I've found that being involved in policy-relevant issues consulting and, you know, working with people in government who are working the same issues has enriched my teaching for sure, but also my scholarship. It's mm-hmm. just it gives you a reality check about the way you're thinking about things that's very important. Also just gives you contacts that can really deepen your knowledge, you know, about the issues mm-hmm. that you're working on. So, I mean, there's a self-interested piece of it, but I also think that there is a moral component to it. And I talk about this a lot at the end of the book, and I think it's an issue that it would behoove us to think a lot more about in the academy, and that's what is our moral obligation to the commonweal? When we do what we do, I mean, we do it because we love it. Some cynics say it's the best part-time job in the world. I won't argue with that. But, you know, I mean, it's personally rewarding, you know, both in terms of, you know, intellectual stimulation and also keeps the wolf from the door. But there ought to be more than that. We ought to be able to say to ourselves that what we're doing is also making a larger contribution, helping to make the world a little bit better place by engaging problems that really matter and that don't just matter on the panel you're at the American Political Science Association convention, which, by the way, sure. is coming up at the end of this month.
Mm-hmm. Along those lines, Mike, I mean, you make the point in the book that one of the more common, perhaps the most common argument against scholarly engagement with policymaking is inherently an ethical one, which is the belief that it corrupts perhaps the integrity of the scientific process to get your hands dirty in policymaking, which is inherently immoral. You can debate all of the premises there, but that is a belief in a large part of the academic community that getting involved in government decision making, no, we can't be complicit in the immoral policies that government sometimes will implement. I think you deconstruct that a little bit in the book just by going back to Max Weber, who most people go to citing, well, he laid it out clearly that someone should not be preaching from the academic chair. You point out
carrying the marshal's baton in his knapsack.
But guess what? Even he was engaged in policy debates. There was a difference. There was the ability to be a researcher, but then to apply that to issues of the day. And isn't that what political science is supposed to be all about? Politics is in the very name of it. So the ethical part is one that I think is important almost. And maybe that plays into the history we'll talk about, is at times when that ethical argument switched and people saw there is a national need for our expertise, usually in times of war. That's when it comes out. So how has that ebbed and flowed over the years? When has the academic community, especially on issues of security studies, engaged more and less with government, and to what effect?
Well, the big conceptual argument in the book is to say that the problem, the cult of the irrelevant, the shorthand for the increasing tendency of academic social scientists to focus inwardly rather than outwardly. I argue that this is a result of disciplinary professionalization. And I make an argument that it's not a clear-cut critique of disciplinary professionalization. You know, I like the ethical argument. you know, I think there are good arguments on both sides of it. My problem is not with disciplinary professionalization per se, but rather with the failure to recognize that there's a downside to it and to understand that in recognizing that downside that you will take steps to counteract it.
Let's explore that. Is it fair to say that the more methods focused a research program is, or let's say an article or a book, the more methods focused it is it inherently less policy relevant?
Yeah, and that is, I think, the heart of the matter, whether it's inevitably the case that as social science professionalizes, as the discipline more regularly uses, you know, the most high-tech tools of social science analysis, it inevitably becomes irrelevant. And the position I take in the book is to say that there's certainly a correlation between these two things. And I think the data on this is pretty much overwhelming and indisputable. But I'm not sure that there's necessarily a causal link there. I think ultimately the big issue is how we frame the research that we do. And as you know, I come down as one of my recommendations at the conclusion of the book to focusing the discipline, focusing on a problem rather than method-driven research agendas. And I think with a problem focus, it's inherently conducive to a methodologically pluralist sort of view of how the discipline ought to be. And so the question isn't, you know, that we replace one methodological hegemony, you know, with another methodological hegemony, but rather we just say, what are the big problems that national security policymakers or our country, in the case of our field, face? And then given those problems, what's the best way to skin the cat?
Right.
And in some cases, the best way to skin the cat may involve formal modeling.
Right, like bargaining and coercion,
right,
for example.
Right. And you know, my discussion of Thomas Schelling, who's, you know, probably one of the most influential academic national security scholars and somebody, you know, who really had an influence on both sides of the bridge between the Beltway and the Ivory Tower. Problem was not that he was an economist and that, you know, he was at least early on enamored of game theory, but rather that he pushed it too far. And he became, you know, sort of a prisoner of his tools rather than saying, what is the problem and how are we going to fix it?
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the issue of the ebbing and flowing, the wartime issues. What were the lessons that were learned from World War I and especially World War II when we saw almost this call to arms within the academic community of contributing to the effort, whether through organized programs within the government or outside? What were the lessons learned from those experiences and what lessons should have been learned from those experiences?
Well, I think the lessons learned, to sort of reinforce the point I was just making, was that the nature of the problem should determine the tools that are employed. And so, you know, World War II is a great illustration of how people from a variety of different methodological approaches on certain issues made very important contributions. And the problem, again, was not that someone like Samuel Stouffer, you know, did early quantitative work primarily, but rather this wasn't the case with him. He very quickly realized the penchant for academic social scientists to get locked into their own tool mindset. But when people sort of missed what the tool was for. I mean, the tool is an instrument for dealing with the problem. That's when issues sort of went off the rail. And that would often, most often, I think, be a development that would manifest itself in peacetime or periods of less intense international threat. The other thing that comes up is disciplinarity. I mean, in the ivory tower, we live in a world defined by disciplinary silos. And the development of disciplines, I readily concede in the book, has been a vehicle for intellectual progress, but it's also been, in a way, an obstacle. And it's amazing. We've been talking about interdisciplinarity for, 80 or 90 years, and recognizing in theory the importance of interdisciplinary work, and in practice, often in wartime, interdisciplinary research comes to the fore. But it's also something that's, we're sort of like Captain Ahab and Moby Dick. You know, it's the white whale that we're always chasing, and we're never able to put the harpoon in.
The example I'm most familiar with is the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS. And everybody, knows stories of sabotage and daring across the world, but they had a massive effort bringing in academics to work in the Office of Research and Analysis, the RNA effort.
The Chairborne Division, the WAGs called it.
And Donovan really liked them, calling them his professors and taking some of their work directly to President Roosevelt at times. Now, on the interdisciplinary issue, the initial division of RNA officers was into isolated geographical, economic, political units, but that shifted during the war to more multidisciplinary groups to reflect the military's overseas theaters. It seemed like there was an evolution even during the war effort. But after the war, what happened is the discipline decided, we need to make ourselves more of a hardcore discipline. We need to copy economics and get more rigor in our work. Why did that lesson not get learned when literally thousands of academics, including many political scientists, went into RNA and had this experience of the benefit of multidisciplinary work?
Well, I think it's a matter of incentives. In wartime, there are very powerful incentives, particularly in the context of total war and at certain periods during the Cold War, for scholars to think more broadly. I mean, especially if they're working in government or doing work that is commissioned by the national security community, to break out of the silos. But for most of us, and certainly this was the case after the major wars and at certain periods during the Cold War and after, when those incentives go away, then the incentives are, what do your colleagues think? Right. What does it take to get promoted and tenured? What sort of work is going to get you a seat on a panel at the American Political Science Association convention? And most importantly, what sort of scholarship is going to appear in the flagship journal? And those are pretty powerful incentives, particularly for younger people.
And I've never heard a tenure decision write, and maybe I'm missing some, but I've never heard of a tenure decision riding on, did a senior government official read the American Political Science Review article that you published that you didn't bother to put a policy prescription or recommendation into? Or did you publish something on a blog that got into government offices and was the subject of a policymaking discussion? Maybe that comes up peripherally, but I don't think any decisions hinge on that as opposed to something more disciplinary.
No, that's absolutely right. And again, I want to be careful to, not take the extreme position that we ought to be tenuring people in academic social science departments based on New York Times op-eds.
But should it be considered? Is that a factor? Because if you change the reward structure, obviously you get different behavior. Is that something that the discipline should consider in terms of weighing that as a factor?
Oh, you bet. Yeah. I mean, I think somebody who publishes an article in a top scholarly journal, a book on a top university press, that also has broader impact measured, there are a lot of different ways you could think about that. I mean, that ought to be an even stronger case, and people should talk about that explicitly as being, above and beyond the call of duty. Now, what's interesting is in universities, where I've spent the last 30 years of my life primarily, there is a recognition at the higher level. I mean, I think once you get out of departments and you get to the deans, the provosts, the presidents, and especially the board of trustees, these sorts of considerations are there. Mm-hmm. So it's really at the, you know, where the disciplinary rubber hits the road that you run into the logjam. And that's why I think to the extent we want to rebalance how people are assessed in terms of promotion and tenure in the academy, the pressure is going to have to come from above. And I think that that would be pushing on an open door, because I think when you get to that level, you feel different incentives. You're a provost of a state university, for example. Not a big part of your budget comes from the state assembly, but a non-trivial chunk of it. And you don't want to be in a position that many academic higher education leaders are in, where the governor or, you know, a member of the state assembly says, what are you guys doing? You know, what these little bitty articles that you're publishing, you know, why should the people of this great state spend money to support your cushy sinecure? Yeah. And if you don't have a good answer for that, you know, you're liable to have an unfortunate surprise when the next state budget comes out.
Let's talk about a few cases where it actually did work, where there was that policy relevant research. And unfortunately, we can't point to thousands of such cases, but there are many cases where it did. One that came to my mind is the framing of appeasement in a theoretical way after World War II affected a whole generation, such that people remarked that George H.W. Bush, when Iraq invaded Kuwait, the mental map he went to, informed somewhat by his own experiences in World War II, but almost certainly by the overall discussion and debate of it, prompted by academic research, was an appeasement model. You don't appease aggression. So that's one example. Another one you discuss in the book briefly is democratic peace theory, which I remember back in graduate school being defined by Jack Levy as the closest thing we had to a universally applicable rule in the realm of international relations, which is the idea that, and it's varied over the years, but the idea that either democracies don't fight each other, or they are unlikely to fight each other, or it will be much, much harder to get them to the point where they do fight each other. But all of those have policy relevance, clearly. But that doesn't always lead to good policy. Talk through that a little bit. The cases where policy relevant research happened, and then how it played out.
Well, I think that there are a fair number of cases where, on balance, the impact of academic or, you know, para-academic social science on policymaking was both very influential and influential for the good. And I think the development of nuclear deterrence theory, right, and our understanding of the impact of nuclear weapons on statecraft is a good illustration of that.
Is it fair to say from the research you did, and you dug into a lot of original documents and did some interviews and things, is it fair to say that policymakers probably would not have come up with the same robust level of deterrence theory without that information from
academics?
Yeah,
I mean, you can never prove a counterfactual mm-hmm. history definitively, but, you know, I think that there's good evidence that this was a whole new technology in a very new political environment, a prolonged period of neither war nor peace. And it took a long time for people to figure out exactly what the impact not only of the technology, but also, and more importantly, from the social science perspective, the impact of the distribution of this right. technology on either side of the conflict dyad. See, I can mm-hmm. speak. Yep. I can speak the lingo.
You're checking the boxes.
Exactly, and so I think without this community of scholars, which really went back and forth between government or, you know, the close to government world and academia, our understanding of this would have been considerably impoverished. And I think the impact was largely for the good. Now, the democratic peace thesis is another example of social science theorizing that has been influential. But I think was the influence good or bad is a little bit more mixed in this particular case.
Because one, and not the only, but one policy decision that comes from democratic peace theory is, well, we need to make more democracies because then they won't fight. But how do you make a democracy in one case, Iraq, by fighting?
Right.
So there's a tension there.
Right. And I, you know, sort of use Bruce Russett from Yale as a bit of the pinata on this thing. And you know, I feel a little bit bad about it because I, you know, my heart is sort of with him in his critique of the George W. Bush's administration's use of a Baldwinized version of Democratic peace thesis to justify the Iraq War and particularly, you know, the American effort at nation building. On the other hand, I think it's an illustration of the problem of taking the scientific purist view. Well, I'm just identifying this causal relationship or this causal regularity, and then I'm not going to sort of spin it out. I'm not going to try to determine whether it's actually causal, which I think he did. And I'm not going to then take the next step and say, given my belief about the causal relationship, these are the policy implications of this. And it would have been nice if you know, the stake had been driven through the argument that the Democratic peace thesis could justify assertive efforts to spread democracy and, you know, large-scale exercises in nation building. So I think, again, there's a cautionary element to that.
And there's also a danger of just recommending that everyone puts policy prescription at the end of their academic article, because some domains are more suited to that than others. Obviously, deterrence theory, absolutely. You know, doing some real work on deterrence, especially nuclear deterrence, there's some obvious policy implications for that that can be drawn out. But on some other issues, it's a lot harder. And that's where I see it from the other side, policymakers getting turned off by academic research that comes in and said, look at this great statistical model. Look at what we've done. We've analyzed this and the correlation is here and here's the variance and this happens. Therefore, yeah, probably more often than not, but not in every case. You want to think about taking into account a country's, I don't know, GDP. Well, that's useless to a policymaker who is meeting with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia tomorrow and wants to know, what talking points do I use to get them to go along with us on Iran? So the policymaker tension is real. The policymaker frustration with academic research is real because not every research project gives useful policy recommendations.
No, and nor should they necessarily. But again, I think the problem, in my view, is that the pendulum has swung too far in one direction, you know, in favor of a sort of scientific purist view. And I think that's a mistake. And I think it's, you know, there are intellectual reasons that this is a bad, you know, sort of ethos for the academy. I also think there are political, you know, reasons that that this is very wrongheaded. And for me, the classic example was the debate, you know, probably 10 years ago now, about continuing National Science Foundation funding for political science.
Right.
And I had the unique perspective on this. I was a member of the APSA Council, the elected, you know,
of the American Political Science Association's Council.
Yeah, the body of our discipline's leading association. It was a 3-year term. So the first year I was on the council, the Coburn Amendment, Tom Coburn was a senator and a doctor from Oklahoma, first sort of reared its ugly head. And it was like the Kubler-Ross stages of death and dying. So the first year we thought, you know, what's this yabo from Oklahoma, you know, doing sticking his nose in our business? This isn't going to go anywhere. Okay, so the second year we're back. We'd meet every year for a couple of days before the APSA annual convention, wherever it was in late August. Second year, Dr. Coburn had not gone away, and it was an even more serious issue. And then we got mad as hell about it. Then the third year, APSA was supposed to be in New Orleans, but Hurricane Katrina came and wiped it out. And I thought, this is divine, divine sanction. But the reality is that Coburn's ethos took on a momentum. And, you know, whether you think he was sincere about it or Minority Whip at the time, Eric Cantor from Virginia, got on this issue as well, too. And he gave a very famous speech in which he raised the question about how do I know, as a steward of the public's funds, whether a dollar spent on political science is better spent there than it would be funding research to find a cure for cancer? And I'm sort of thinking to myself, we should be able to answer that question. We didn't that time. And the NSF funding for political science was substantially trimmed for a couple of years after that. But that's been a recurrent thing, you know, going back to the late 60s and early 70s when Senator Mike Mansfield, you know, pushed a similar sort of effort. So we need to understand that if we're going to enjoy the support of society, we're also going to have to be able to tell society that, you know, supporting us is going to contribute to making their lives a little bit better.
And this is not unique to political science, but it's an acute problem for political science because of the nature of the study. That is, it's political behavior. There are some aspects of political science, which I think we most often see in the subfield of American politics, that are perhaps better suited to quantitative methods.
Right.
You have robust data on elections, let's say in the United States, such that a professor of mine, I remember sitting in a statistical methods class, him spending 75 minutes doing a proof on three different whiteboards around the room to show some aspect of the importance of the statistical significance of non-responses in survey data. Now, that could be applied to political surveys, but it was inherently a math problem. And the policy relevance for that might end up being one sentence, like craft your surveys carefully or take into account non-responses more. Okay, that maybe that does work. But that's different than some political questions, which are, what's the best policy to balance economic freedom and political freedom? You're not going to get a good statistical analysis of that, and yet both exist in the same field called political science. Some departments don't even use political science. They call it government, old school, or politics.
Yeah, I was going to say they're fewer and fewer. The department I'm in at Notre Dame used to be a Department of Government and International Studies. And well before I got there, it was renamed Political Science. And so I, you know, the way I think about this is, you know, again, there's a bit of a paradox because a lot of routine political behavior, particularly in Congress, is, as you said, David, amenable to statistical study and also, you know, seems to fit well, you know, with certain straightforward models that, you know, legislators would want to be reelected. And so, you know, that would be a pretty reliable guide to what their political behavior would be like. And I think in normal times, that probably tells you a lot of important things you need to know about congressional behavior. But what about times like the times we're living in now, where political behavior seems to be governed by very different sets of motives? And do we want to be in a position, and here maybe I'm being unfair to my colleagues in American politics, but I do think our discipline missed a lot of the changes over the past 10 or 15 years that have really, you know, revolutionized our politics, our domestic politics in a big way.
And part of that is an inherent, it's necessary when you have a discipline that becomes more and more defined is, yes, there can be cross-disciplinary work, but are people really valuing in terms of dissertations, in terms of publications, are people really valuing some good political science research that incorporates sociology, anthropology, psychology, history, or in the American Political Science Review, are you more likely to get published if it is a hardcore straight methods argument about a core American politics problem? It doesn't seem to me that the value of each discipline is to celebrate the work that borrows on other disciplines.
Yeah, and I think that's a huge problem. And one, I have to be candid, I'm not sure that I've done more than identify the problem. You know, I'm to go and figure out how you would regularly break down the disciplinary silos without losing, you know, some of the advantages of disciplinary specialization.
There's one model, and this is the model that came up in the U.S. military, which is what's happening when we have people in the Army and in the Navy and in the Air Force and in the Marine, and they never leave and they become siloed. Well, you have purple assignments. You are required to serve in a joint assignment at some point.
So we need a Goldwater Nichols for
academia, which is to say, you know what? Go spend a year working with a psychology department if your work is somewhat relevant to that field and find out, what are the methods and what are the things that are happening there that have been essentially pushed out of our discipline? It's a model, and I think there are some huge problems with it, but it's the idea of making sure that people don't become blinded by their own research methods.
Yeah, and I had a long discussion yesterday with David Montgomery, who's the OSD policy guy that mm-hmm. has the primary responsibility for the Minerva Initiative. And I think people like him in government-sponsored research, you know, NSF and NIH, recognize that a lot of the big problems that they want to direct government support to trying to illuminate are likely to be interdisciplinary. You know, so they recognize that, but they also recognize the obstacles for trying to overcome it. We had a workshop out here just up the road in early June on disciplinarity and sort of thinking about some of these issues from the perspective of the STEM disciplines, engineering, medicine, and things like that. And all university disciplines, to a certain extent, face these challenges. And the question is how you can overcome them. And I think when government funding agencies like NIH or NSF explicitly target money to encourage interdisciplinary research, that's a good thing.
Sure.
And again, it's not a silver bullet,
right?
But there are no silver bullets, unfortunately, right, for any of these problems.
One of the areas you look at involves scholars who have gone into government and really applied their work in senior policymaking jobs. You discuss Henry Kissinger, Zbigniew Brzezinski. One of your largest case studies is on Walt Rostow, national security advisor, heavily involved, of course, in the Vietnam effort with the Lyndon Johnson administration. Talk just a little bit about your takeaway from doing that deep dive and looking at the case of somebody who was both in the academic world, had background in academia, but was making policy based in part on some, no kidding, academic theories being put into action.
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that case because it really cuts to the heart of why I am pushing the whole issue of the relevance question mm-hmm. in academia. Because the cases of Brzezinski and Kissinger and a host of other lesser lights in social sciences, that they recognize the cult of the irrelevant. But they threw up their hands and said, it's unreformable.
I'm done with it. I'll do the policy job, and I'm not even going to try to bridge the gap
anymore.
I'm
crossing the bridge, and it's going to become a drawbridge. Mm-hmm. We'll pull up the bridge and not worry about what's happening in the ivory tower. You know, that's sort of a seductive approach, because as a former department chair and an academic administrator myself, I understand the challenges of turning around the supertanker on fundamental issues like this. But I don't think that ultimately, and this is where Rostow is so important, that the panacea is for somebody like Rostow to just say the hell with academia and become a bureaucrat. Because, and with all due respect to your former profession and the many well-intentioned and very smart men and women who serve in government, that loses, going back to my classical liberal marketplace of ideas, the unique perspectives that the academy can bring to these debates. So it's not a good thing if the Rostows cross the bridge and never go back, because I don't think they'll be good policymakers at the end of the day. And I also think that the gap that they leave behind will mean that the policy relevant space in academia will get smaller and smaller. So for me, one of the real heroes of the book is Sam Huntington, who crossed the bridge. Joe Nye, I guess, would be another good example from Harvard, but also went back and forth. And, you know, Sam, you know, was deeply engaged in policy issues throughout his career, but he was also deeply committed to being a world-class social scientist. And, you know, whatever you think about his later work, he made some really fundamental contributions in comparative politics, political theory, international relations early on. And we'll not all be Sam Huntington's, but if we all aspired to be Sam Huntington or recognized that Sam Huntington was great, not only because he was a great political scientist, but because it was political science that was regularly addressed to broader issues, I think we'd be a much healthier discipline.
You also give the counter case, unfortunately, of a case, I believe it was in the 1980s, when Samuel Huntington himself had raised funds to endow a chair in the government department to focus on national security studies. And they offered the chair to, I think, Richard Betts, well-established in research circles, but also policy relevant. And that fell apart. So even when all the pieces are put together right to do this, sometimes it just doesn't click.
Right, right. Yeah, and the Betts case is a good illustration. It's no accident, comrade, that thing fell apart in 1989, precisely at the time that the Berlin Wall was falling and it looked like the end of the Cold War. And there were a lot of people who said, security studies, maybe it was important before, but it's sort of a, you know, has sketchy intellectual credentials. So, why do we need a chair in this? Or why do we need somebody who's spent a lot of his career actually here at Brookings, although doing, in my judgment, really good work while he was here at Brookings?
So let me end with you going out on a limb here to look to the future and tell me whether you are negative or positive, whether you are pessimistic or optimistic about the ability both of political science and security studies more particularly to be more policy relevant absent a major war. And we should not root for that as a way to solve this other problem. But for the ability for the discipline to be more policy relevant, but also for policymakers who are also increasingly specialized in some areas to be more open to what scholarship can bring them. How do you feel about that?
Well, it's an ongoing challenge, but it's a challenge that I think is worth flagging and worth injecting into not only the discussion among political scientists, but also more generally, which is to say, you know, look, disciplinary development and specialization is a double-edged sword. Let's recognize the double-edged nature of it, and let's think about the ways of trying to get our cake and eat it too in terms of academic engagement with policy, particularly among social scientists. Whether I'm an optimist or a pessimist, I mean, that's sort of, you know, hard to say. And you sort of set me up with this. We got to root for World War III to fix the problem. I think that like any real world problem, it's not going to be fixed right away. And it's going to be a long term thing that we're just going to have to maintain a constant commitment to thinking about. And I think that by raising, I hope that by raising these issues, that it's going to start a conversation or continue a conversation that's going to bring in a broader swath of people and put my academic colleagues in conversation with the higher level administrators at their universities and with the public, in which they have to think, what should I be able to say to the provost about what I'm doing beyond disciplinary excellence? What am I going to be able to say to the governor of my state if I'm at a public university, or if I'm at a private university? What am I going to say to a member of Congress who's thinking about NSF funding for political science that answers Majority Whip Eric Cantor's very important question about why a dollar for political science is better spent on us than something else. And as long as we're constantly thinking about that, I think we'll be moving in a healthier direction than we are now.
And let me springboard off of that to put out a plug, which is for you and others working on national security topics, anything policy relevant at the nexus of national security, law, and policy, just as we do with many law professors. If the American Political Science Review isn't interested in your work because it doesn't have formal methodology or statistical rigor, but it is directly relevant to policymaking and decision making at the national level, Lawfare is a great place to get that work published. Thank you very much, Mike.
Well, thank you, David, for having me here. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Michael Desch for coming on the show. Please share the Lawfare podcast and give us a 5-star review on iTunes. The podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howe, and our audio engineer this week is Vishnu Kannan. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thank you for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.